Okay, so far in our exploration of the Udana, we've been particularly focused on the Buddha and the response of a particular individual, namely Bhāhya, to the Buddha. And I even related Bhāhya's story to our private ordination ceremony. I don't know if that was followed up at all in the groups, but anyway. Today we're going to look at a sutta that deals with the spiritual community, with the Sangha. And the sutta occurs in chapter 5 of the Udana, the chapter called Sona. And it's the fifth sutta in that chapter. And again, the setting is near to the great city of Sarvati. But this time, the Buddha is staying in a place called the Eastern Park, at a place called Megara's Mother's Mansion. Megara's mother being a prominent woman, lay disciple of the Buddha. And the Buddha is sitting, surrounded by the order of bhikkhus. On the day of the Uposatha observance, the Uposatha or observance day occurred twice a month, on the new and full moon days, and these were regarded as being of very, very great importance indeed. On Uposatha days, all of the bhikkhus in the area would come together, and it seems that they would do this at night, where they would sit together. And this was probably a practice that even predates the Buddha and his Sangha. We need to remember that the Buddha and his Sangha, were not the only community of wandering ascetics, as we might call them, the samanas, as they were known. The Buddhist community was known, well, they were known as the Sakyaputta samanas, the wanderers who were the sons of the Sakyan, the wanderers who were the sons of the Buddha. And there were many communities of wanderers. There were the Niganthas, for example, the so-called Jain communities, many communities of wanderers. And it seems that it was a common practice for them to meet on the new and full moon days. And it's very clear that the Buddha regarded such gatherings of the order as extraordinarily important for the spiritual health, both of the individual bhikkhu, as well as for the community of bhikkhus, for the whole Sangha, for both the individual and, as it were, the collective. And towards the end of his life, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha said that such gatherings were one of the most important things for the spiritual health of the individual and of the order. So long as the bhikkhus meet together repeatedly and in large numbers, we can expect to see their spiritual wealth and not their decay. So long as they meet in harmony and conduct their activities in harmony, then we will see the health and wealth, the spiritual health and wealth of the community and not its decay. And we follow this in our own tradition, of course. Very early on in the history of the order, Sangharakshita instituted weekly chapter meetings. In the early days, we called them weekly order meetings because there were so few of us. But now they're weekly chapter meetings, and we also have our large local and regional order weekends. We also have large international order gatherings and conventions, and these are regarded as being of very great importance for the health of the Sangha, as well as for the individuals within it. And in the earliest days of the Buddhist Sangha, the Sangha would gather to recite or to hear recited the Patimokkha. Patimokkha in Pali. And we see reference to this in this sutta. After the monks had gathered Ananda throughout the course of the night, repeatedly asks the Buddha to recite the Patimokkha to all the bhikkhus gathered. But the Buddha stays silent in relation to this request. Right up until the dawn, and Ananda's third request. Again, Ananda says, we're all gathered, the bhikkhus are all gathered, now it's time for you to recite the Patimokkha. But then the Buddha explains why he won't recite the Patimokkha. And we'll look at the whys and wherefores of that a little bit later. First of all, I want to say something about this word Patimokkha. Patimokkha. It's a very ancient word and a very important word, actually, in early Buddhism. And scholars have had trouble working out its real, if you like, meaning, its original meaning and its etymology. I won't go into the etymology of it. Over the centuries, the Patimokkha came to mean the long list of rules that the fully ordained bhikkhu takes. Originally, however, the Patimokkha was probably a set of pithy verses that encapsulated the teaching and the training and practice of a particular samana community. Some scholars believe, in fact, that the original Patimokkha of the earliest Buddhist Sangha are the following verses found in the Dhammapada, in the Buddhavagga, the chapter of the Enlightened One, which go like this, very famous verses. Verses 183 to 185. I'm using Bhante's translation. The not doing of anything evil, undertaking to do what is ethically skillful, and complete purification of the mind, this is the ordinance of the Enlightened Ones. Patient endurance is the best form of penance. Nirvana is the highest, say the Enlightened Ones. No true goer forth from the household life is he who injures another, nor is he a true ascetic who persecutes others. Not to speak evil, not to injure, to exercise restraint through the observance of the almsman's code of conduct, to be moderate in diet, and to occupy oneself with higher mental states, this is the ordinance of the Enlightened Ones. So it's possible that Ananda is asking, and the community is waiting for the Buddha to recite these verses, or some essential basic ethical code. Just to point out, in our own order, of course, we have our own Patimokkha, our own basic ethical code. That's the 10 precepts, the Dasa Kusala Dhamma, the 10 ways of skillful action, or the 10 Shiksha Padas, the 10 great training principles. And this Patimokkha we take at ordination. We take it in both the negative form, in terms of what we abstain from, and we take the Patimokkha in its positive form, which expresses the spirit and real meaning of the precepts, what we're actually trying to do with our lives. Bhante has in fact described our 10 precepts as a mula, or the mula pratimoksha, or the fundamental ethical code of Buddhism. The ethical code that underlies all the different ethical codes known in Buddhist tradition. You can read all this up in the first part of the 10 Pillars of Buddhism. Very important discussion. And usually in order gatherings, including the weekly chapter meeting, order members will recite those 10 precepts together, right at the beginning of the chapter meeting. So we're following a very ancient Buddhist tradition that goes back to the earliest days of Buddhism, reciting our Patimokkha before entering into our chapter business. But in the sutta, the Buddha stays silent at Ananda's repeated requests to recite the Patimokkha. And I'm sure you can imagine the atmosphere as they all sat there. I'm sure at least some of the bhikkhus were wondering, what is going on? I mean, you know, they've been around probably the Buddha long enough to know that, yes, the Buddha does, you know, he usually will follow the tradition. And they'll know that sometimes he can be, you know, he might do strange things. You know, there's this mystery around the Buddha. So what is going on? Why won't the Buddha chant? Why won't he chant the Patimokkha and, in a way, get the order meeting going, as it were? Why isn't he following the tradition? And they all sit there in silence. And at last, just as the dawn is breaking, in response to Ananda's third time of asking, the Buddha just says, "The gathering is not pure, Ananda. The gathering is not pure, Ananda. And you can imagine the electricity in the atmosphere at these words, with probably some of the bhikkhus thinking, who is it that is impure? Yeah. And Mahamoggallana, one of the Buddha's chief disciples, one of his great Dhamma Senapatis, great generals of the doctrine, famous for his psychic powers, took in the whole gathering with his mind, and he saw who the impure person, the impure bhikkhu was. We're not told their name, we're not even told what they've done. But there was obviously something very seriously wrong with this person, because the text says that Mahamoggallana saw that person sitting in the midst of the order of bhikkhus, immoral, wicked, of impure and suspect behaviour, secretive in his acts, no recluse, that's a summoner, one gone forth, no recluse, though pretending to be one, not practising the holy life, though pretending to do so, rotten within, lustful and corrupt. The old Victorian translation, Woodward's translation, I think uses the phrase, a rubbish heap of filth. So no, you know, no sort of NVC language here. It's very, very strong language. And on seeing him, seeing this person, this impure person, Moggallana goes up to him and he says, friend, get up. Friend, you've been seen by the Buddha. And you've been seen. And you can't live in communion with the bhikkhus. And the person stays silent, doesn't move. So Moggallana says again, and he's polite but firm, friend, you've been seen. It's not suitable for you to dwell with the community. And there's still silence. Until Mahamoggallana has to take hold of him by the arm, and he takes him to the gate of where they're dwelling. He goes through the gate, pulls him out, casts him out of the gathering, and then comes back to the Buddha and says to the Buddha, the assembly is now quite pure, very pure, and now the Patimokkha can be recited. The Buddha comments how strange it is, how remarkable, how that stupid person should have waited until he was taken by the arm. And the Buddha also announces that he will no longer participate in the Uposatha days and recite the Patimokkha, because, as the text has it, it cannot happen that the Tathagata should participate in the Uposatha observance and recite the Patimokkha with a gathering that is not pure. And the Buddha then gives a wonderful teaching, likening the Dhamma Vinaya, actually, to the great and mighty ocean, and he concludes that great teaching with a riddling udana. But before we look into all that, we need to look at the incident more closely. We need to look at it because it touches on issues of very great importance to our spiritual community, to our own order, to spiritual communities in principle. First thing I want to look at is the Buddha's silence, his refusal to recite the Patimokkha. It's obviously the custom to begin a gathering of the order that way, because Ananda is concerned and he keeps asking. But Ananda is very, very good at this. He's very, very, you know, if there's the community comes together, he's very concerned that there's, you know, the communication flows. But the Buddha refuses. He keeps silent. And the Buddha's refusal, his silence, no matter how awkward that might have been for everybody, what it's doing is creating a space. That silence is creating a space. It's creating a space for the confession of faults, the confession of evil, to give its traditional name, papadeshana. The deshana means something like the showing, the revealing of faults, of unskillfulness, to spiritual friends. The point is that showing and that revealing is done by oneself, on one's own initiative. One volunteers it oneself. One takes responsibility for one's unskillfulness and volunteers it oneself. It can't be done through any kind of pressure. You can't do it because you're told to do it. You do it because you see the unskillfulness and you want to show that, reveal that, open that, confess that to your spiritual friends. And you want to do it without any holding back. So the Buddha's silence, the space he is creating, is an act of treating all those present seriously. He's treating them as committed Dharma practitioners who are capable of taking responsibility for their actions and capable of being honest and open about their ethical failings. And this is something that happens in many order chapters. At the beginning of the chapter meeting, there is a silent space where everybody has the opportunity to confess their faults. And the expectation is that each one of us in the chapter takes responsibility for ourselves, takes the initiative to reveal, to disclose, to open up, to confess. You might even say, even before that, to review what's gone on in the previous week, to really look at ourselves in the light of our ethics, in the light of our Patimokkha, in the light of our 10 precepts. So in that silent space, the Buddha is giving that impure person, as the text puts it, the opportunity to open up and confess. There is quite a discussion about this incident in the second Udana seminar, 1975. It's very interesting. There's more of a discussion in the 75 seminar than the 74 seminar. And I think that might mean that within that year, there'd probably been a bit more, you know, perhaps a lot more experience of spiritual community by the order members. You know, in those days, things happened very fast, I think, in the Sangha. And there's a very lively discussion of this. And Bhante asks those present, the order members, and I think there were some Mitras present, why doesn't this bhikkhu open up? Why doesn't he confess? And someone replies, because of fear. And Bhante asks, well, fear of what? And somebody replies, fear of being damaged through their feelings. And Bhante says this in response to that: but do you think this particular monk really felt or thought that the Buddha would damage him? Surely he would have realized that the Buddha would have been the most sympathetic listener, would have really wanted to help him. And later on there is a discussion about trust and faith, and Bhante says, clearly that particular monk had no trust in the Buddha, no faith in the Buddha, no faith in the other monks, maybe no faith in the Dharma either. For him, there was no spiritual community. This is why, no doubt, the Buddha says later on in his Dhamma teaching in this sutta, though monks, he be seated in the midst of the order, yet he is far away from the order. Far away is the order from him. He experiences the order as a threatening situation, but that's his big mistake. He should have tried to see and feel the spiritual community as a very safe and secure situation. If we don't have that sort of faith and trust, which are positive emotions, then we can't open ourselves. We will go on hiding and covering up. And it would seem that the monk, the bhikkhu, who refuses to confess, to open up, is in quite an extreme state. It says, you know, he has the outward appearance of a monk, of a full-timer, a holy man. But in reality, he is not like that at all. I mean, it sounds though he's a bit of a hypocrite. He's got all the front, but inside there's the opposite. And that suggests that he has turned being a monk, being a bhikkhu, into a status, into a position. And he has turned the Buddha and the other bhikkhus into authority figures. It's all about appearance and what he can get away with. And this does seem to have happened in the Sangha, even in the Buddha's time. And it was so extreme that the Sangha had to take action, had to make it clear, not just within itself, but perhaps even signalling to the wider society, had to make it clear that such people were in fact not actually part of the Sangha. Moggallana has to forcibly remove this man from the assembly. And later in his discourse on the Dharma, the Buddha says, just as the great and mighty ocean throws up a dead body, in the same way the order will not tolerate someone who is not really practicing the Dharma. Well, this is all very strong and stirring material, and it could be that we feel that it doesn't really apply to ourselves. If we look at ourselves, I'm sure we'll all feel that we're making a sincere and serious effort to practice the Dharma. I don't think this evening Artapriya is going to say before the puja, the assembly is not wholly pure. And then Surata, who's famous for his psychic powers, will come up and throw all of us out. I'm sure that won't happen. At the same time, it can happen that people feel that they have to hide things in order to do well in our Sangha, even to get ordained. And I've certainly seen this over the years. I've experienced people sometimes as not fully present, whether it's on a going for refuge retreat or if I'm meeting them at their centre, they're not fully present, they're not fully available. In the study groups on going for refuge retreats, they're not all there. And it's obvious that they're good people, but there's a kind of blockage. It's as if they're not all there. They're doing the right things, saying the right things, but one feels that there is something missing, an energy, a vitality, a presence. They may even be quite boring. And as you get to know them more deeply, they start to reveal more about themselves. They start to open up. I mean, I understand this process. You know, it takes time to open up to one another. It's not that they're bad people for that. Actually, sometimes what they think is unacceptable to others is completely innocuous. It's completely innocuous when it sort of emerges. It's nothing, but they've turned it into something huge. Somehow they feel it would be unacceptable if others knew about this. Sometimes it can be a serious reservation about aspects of the order and the Dharma. A serious reservation about the order and the Dharma, which they keep quiet about in order to get ordained. I'll sort it out later. Sometimes it is indeed something really unskillful, a really unskillful habit, or something in the past that needs sorting out, but they don't want to mention it because they want to get ordained, so they want to put on this show. Whatever it is, it's always a relief when they bring it into the light. It's a relief for them. It's a relief for order members. It's a relief for everybody. Then, whatever it is, can be seen for what it is, can be seen and known clearly. Energy is released, and life, including Dharma life, becomes much clearer and much more straightforward. Doesn't mean it's going to get any easier. In some ways, it might get more difficult, but it's clear. But really the worst thing to do is to put on a show to get ordained. To put on a show when you're an order member. If you do that, it's like building a house on a fault line. Sooner or later, that house, that edifice, will come tumbling down. There's a great emphasis in the Dharmacharini ordination ceremony, especially the public ordination ceremony, on purification. Purification. All the verses are about purification. We're anointed with special purified water on the crown of our heads. We are invested with a white kesa. So it's very, the symbolism here is really important. The Dharmachari's life is a life of continuous purification. So it's, and of course before ordination, we need to see the ordination process as a time of purification, even intense purification, purification of motivation, purification of behaviour, so that everything is clear and as concentrated as possible to live the Dharma life. And to purify, we need to be completely honest with ourselves, with our spiritual friends, honest in the light of the spiritual ideal, in the light of the refuges, in the light of the precepts. And of course, after ordination as well, we need to keep the going for refuge pure, clean. And we don't do that through pretending to be perfect. We do it, of course, by being honest, truthful, and open to spiritual friends. So it's a process of purification, not a pretense of purification. All this, obviously, all this means that we need to create a very strong atmosphere of metta, of loving kindness, of friendliness and friendship within the spiritual community, so that there is real confidence to be able to fully open up. This is so important. It's one of the reasons why we place so much emphasis on metta, on spiritual friendship, on friendliness, on human friendliness, so that there can be this continuous opening up and this release of energy, and also this understanding of what we need to do. And you know, I've been very, very struck in this respect by the, if you like, the sensitivity within the spiritual community. I've certainly experienced that myself. There was a period in my life which I was very ashamed of, after I was ordained, this was, and I felt that until I'd confessed this fully to the order, I couldn't hold my head up in the order. I had to reveal my faults. I actually wrote quite a strong confessional letter to Shabda, the order journal, and people said, yes, it's true, you were like that. There was no sort of, no, you're fine, you were fine. No, you were like that. But it's so good to hear you say it, to be truthful. It was very, very striking, the response I got, the truly, genuinely sympathetic response I got from other order members. People were pleased that I was, as it were, back with them. But I've seen it also in going for refuge retreats. In the summer, on a 10 Pillars of Buddhism retreat, I was very struck by this. There was a group I was in, and none of us really knew each other in this group, and in the evenings, as we do on the 10 Pillars retreat, people told their sort of ethical history, told their life from the point of view of ethics, from the point of view of, you know, looking at their sort of successes and even and their failures in terms of ethics and the sort of growth of conscience. And I was really very, very struck by the honesty and the intelligent openness that people brought to their life stories, and the intelligence with which people listened. It was very, very striking, gave me a lot of confidence in our community of men who've asked for ordination. People didn't know each other, but the atmosphere, and I asked them, you know, how is this? And they said one factor was being at Padmaloka. There was a sort of atmosphere which, in a way, drew something forth in them. We can't force this. We can't force this opening. It has to come out of metta, and it has to be individual. It has to come from our own serious engagement with the Dharma, the intensity of going for refuge, and yes, our engagement with spiritual friends. And yes, that's why we place so much emphasis on friendship, on spiritual community, on chapter meetings, on going for refuge groups. I know many men who've asked for ordination in going for refuge groups, and they tell me about their groups, and I'm very, very struck by the closeness of friendship that develops, and the obvious openness and honesty between people. That's a wonderful sign. So the light of the Dharma, when we have these situations, the light of the Dharma can shine into the sort of deepest, most tender, most difficult areas of our lives and our consciousness. I'm going to return to this topic of openness and confession a little later, but before that I want to look at the Dhamma teaching that the Buddha gives after the assembly of monks has been purified. It really is a majestic Dharma discourse. If you want to read a really good commentary on it, read Sangharakshita's The Taste of Freedom, because he explores this discourse. Yes, it's a magical Dharma discourse, a sublime Dharma discourse. The Buddha obviously feels that everybody present really wants to hear the Dharma, really wants to practice the Dharma. There's a real openness there. They really want to live the Dharma life, want to enter into the Dharma life, enter into the Dharma. And he starts speaking, well, not about the Dharma actually, he starts talking about the great and mighty ocean. He talks about the eight great qualities of the great and mighty ocean, the eight wondrous qualities of the great and mighty ocean. You know, so you must imagine sitting there, there's this very dramatic event, the dawn is coming up, and suddenly the Buddha starts talking about the great and mighty ocean. It's a bit stilted in the Pali, but you can imagine, he suddenly just starts talking about the ocean. You probably think, what's happening? He's talking about the ocean. You know, why is he talking about the ocean? And this is something in itself, because the Buddha and his disciples lived a very long way away from the great and mighty ocean. Well, they knew that the river, you know, parts of the, sometimes, you know, bits of the river Ganges can be, you can't see the other shore sometimes. But they didn't have, or very few of them, would have had any actual experience of this vast, seemingly endless body of water of incredible depth and mystery. The ocean would have been to them vast, mysterious, strange, and magical, and just something, you know, it's the stuff of travellers' tales, this great ocean filled with all sorts of wonders. And of course, it was the pre-scientific era, it's, you know, before, you know, David Attenborough. And so, mind you, he does make it clear how wonderful it is. So, you know, the lore, L-O-R-E, about the great and mighty ocean would have been mythic lore. It's this vast body of water going on and on, filled with jewels and monsters and, wow. So the Buddha starts like that, talking about the ocean. They've got that in their mind, the vastness of the ocean with all its qualities. And then the Buddha likens the Dhamma to the great and mighty ocean. Not just the Dhamma, what he calls the Dhamma Vinaya. The Dhamma Vinaya, which really you could roughly translate as the principle and the practice, or the truth, or reality and its application. Reality and its practice. So it's the profound depths and its actual application in life. So he talks about the eight wonderful and marvellous qualities of the ocean, of the Dharma, comparing that to the ocean. I'm just going to briefly give a summary of all that. So as the ocean gradually shelves and slopes down, there's no abrupt precipice, that's the law that the Buddha inherited, In the same way, in the Dhamma Vinaya, there is a gradual training and progression. There is no sudden penetration to final knowledge. So in the Dharma, there's gradual, progressive development. Ethics, meditation, wisdom, liberation. There's regular steps. Secondly, again, the Buddha is definitely not an oceanographer. The ocean is stable. It doesn't transgress its limits. In the same way, the Buddha says, my disciples, by which he must mean my true disciples, people who can really say that they're my disciples, do not transgress the training. They don't break the precepts. They don't transgress the training, even for the sake of their lives. Even for the sake of their lives. Thirdly, just as the ocean does not tolerate a dead body and casts it up onto dry land, a corpse, so the Sangha does not tolerate someone who's only pretending to lead the spiritual life. They will be thrown up sooner or later, cast up out of the Sangha. Fourthly, just as the rivers lose their individual names like Ganges, Yamuna, Sarasvati, and so on, just as they lose their individual names when they flow into the great and mighty ocean, so people lose their caste names. They lose their caste names, their former identities, when they enter into the Sangha, and they are known only as Sakyaputta Samanas, sons of the Buddha. In other words, when you enter the order, when you enter the Sangha, you have no worldly status at all. That's all gone when you enter the Sangha. You no longer relate through caste or class or any kind of position, nationality, whatever it might be. And of course, this is symbolized very strongly in our own order. At ordination, you take a Dharma name. You're given a Dharma name. You're dying to your old identity. You're spiritually reborn in the Sangha. The sixth quality: whatever rivers enter the ocean, whatever rain falls into it, there's no lessening or filling of the ocean. It's stable. Again, leave aside the science. And the Buddha says, whoever gains nirvana, there's no lessening or filling up of nirvana. If Surata gains nirvana tomorrow, there won't be less nirvana available to us. He won't have got a bit of it for more of it for himself than we'll get. But and Bhante comments on this. What's really going on here is making it clear that nirvana, enlightenment, is not a thing that you have or own. You don't get a bit of it. In the seminar, he says it's warning against any idea that nirvana, enlightenment, is simply a state of mind. It's completely beyond all conceptions of self and other. It's not got any quantity. I think it's here in the text itself. It talks about nirvana as a dhatu, as a realm. And it's probably that's a much better way of thinking of nirvana, of thinking of wisdom, of thinking even of insight. It's more like something that you're entering something as vast as the ocean, although that's only a manner of speaking. I was thinking about this with this language of stream entry, which, Sankaracharya says that we should all be aiming for in this life. Entering the stream. Well, you think about that very language gets away from any idea of insight and wisdom as a personal possession. When you enter a stream, you are borne along by the stream. So you can also talk about nirvana or wisdom or insight as opening up. Subhuti, in a recent paper, quoting something of Bhante's, it's more like opening up to a sort of suprapersonal spiritual force. And this is where I think the language of the arising of the bodhicitta is much more helpful if we're talking about wisdom and enlightenment. Something much, much bigger than us that we sort of serve and give ourselves to. And then the next quality, very famously, just as the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, so the Dhamma Vinaya has one taste, the taste of freedom, the taste of liberation, the vimutti rasa. Which means that the Dhamma Vinaya, of course, is a matter of direct experience, of immediate taste, of the taste of liberation. And vimutti here is no ordinary freedom. It's the taste of nirvana. Seventhly, just as the ocean is full of the most wonderful jewels and gemstones, and these are listed, wonderful treasures, so the Dhamma Vinaya is full of treasures. Within the Dhamma Vinaya there are the four foundations of mindfulness, the five spiritual faculties, the five powers, the Eightfold Path, and so on. All these wonderful teachings and practices can be found in the Dhamma Vinaya. And again, this is interesting. It's saying that these practices are, you know, the Dhamma Vinaya is bigger even than these very distinctive Buddhist practices. And then finally, just as the great and mighty ocean is full of great fish, great creatures, monsters of the deep, nagas, leviathans, asuras, all sorts of extraordinary creatures are mentioned. In the same way, the Dhamma Vinaya is filled with great monsters. Great creatures of the deep, stream entrants, once returners, non-returners, arahants, and in his own discourse on this, Bhante said you could also add bodhisattvas, gurus, dharkas, dharkinis. These creatures inhabit the depths of the ocean. But again, the implication is that the Dhamma Vinaya is bigger even than these great creatures. So I really love this teaching. It's a wonderful teaching, making it clear that the Dhamma Vinaya is vast and mysterious. I mean, the Buddha lists eight qualities, but of course there are innumerable qualities. Now, the Dhamma Vinaya includes, or even is, reality itself. It's nirvana. It's also the Sangha. It's the spiritual community. It's all of the different practices. It's the great beings who inhabit the Dharma. So what the Buddha is evoking here is the vast Dharma realm, what Sangharakshita is also called the Dharma Niyama. And we can enter that when we go for refuge. We enter that when we go for refuge. We enter the Dhamma Vinaya. It's bigger than us. It's greater than us. And I love the idea of the Dharmachari. Our ordination is the Dharmachari ordination. Charya means something like to walk in, to fare in, but it also means to course in. You could even say to frolic in and to play in. That's what we're doing when we go for refuge, when we enter the Dhamma Vinaya, the great ocean of the Dhamma Vinaya. And it's very interesting that the Buddha gives such a discourse on the Dharma on this occasion. It's as if he wants to make it clear that the Dhamma Vinaya is not something that we can use to give ourselves status and position. It's something that we need to give ourselves up to. We need to surrender to. We need to fully open up to. Sometimes when we discuss, this is within the order itself, when we just discuss people who want to be ordained, we find ourselves saying, he wants to be ordained on his own terms. Sometimes that phrase is used. He wants to go for refuge on his own terms. In other words, he wants to go for refuge or be ordained without really changing, without really transforming, without really giving himself up. Well, that's a contradiction in terms. The image of the Dhamma Vinaya as being like the great, mighty and wonderful ocean communicates that we cannot possess and own the Dharma on our terms. It's something that we plunge into and surrender to. And when you do that, confession is natural. Complete honesty and no openness about failings is natural. So let's return to that topic of confession and openness. The Buddha returns to that topic because at the end of his discourse, he's deeply inspired. You know, it's interesting. There's this whole event going on and he's given a Dharma discourse. And it's almost as if in communicating the Dharma in this way, evoking the Dharma in this way, he sort of inspired himself. He's deeply inspired. The Buddha breathes forth his Udana, his inspired utterance. And I'm going to use a much older translation because I prefer it. And it's the one that Bhante used in the seminar, this translation. And I'm deliberately using this because I'm going to read from Bhante's commentary on this. So there's a word here that's used, thatch, as in the sense of a thatched roof. So the Udana is this: it rains through the thatch. It rains not through the open. So open up the thatched, thus it will not rain through. It rains through the thatch. It rains not through the open. So open up the thatched, thus it will not rain through. So I'm going to read quite a long section now from the seminar, because I really like it, and you also get to hear Bhante. That's quite a paradox. It harks back to the original incident of the monk who tried to cover up his unspiritual life. People generally tend to think in terms of protecting themselves by covering up. But here the Buddha is saying that it is the open that is protected, not the closed, not the covered. The Buddha says in the Dhammapada, the Dharma protects him who practices the Dharma. This particular monk thought he could protect himself by covering up his offences, but he would have been protected if he had been more open, if he'd confessed and asked for help. So as the verse implies, if one tries to cover up, then the rain will come right through. In the long run, one will suffer. But if one opens up, if one doesn't try to cover or hide anything, then one will be perfectly safe and protected. This ties in with the whole idea of confession. By bringing things out into the open, though not in a self-indulgent way. Being open doesn't involve exhibitionism or anything of that sort. What the Buddha is really talking about here is openness within the spiritual community, not concealing one's faults and failings from others, and being able to ask for help if necessary. One has to acknowledge where one is, even though it may be a very unpleasant and undesirable place to be in. Otherwise, one will not be able to move on. If one tries to keep up a pretense, then one is in a very false position. If on any particular occasion one feels that someone isn't being quite open or completely honest or is trying to cover up, then one should very gently tackle them about it, not only for their own good, but for one's own good and the good of the whole spiritual community. If everybody is covering up, even to a very slight degree, there is no genuine communication and therefore no real community. This ties up with the wrong view of having a private life. You don't have a private life in the spiritual community. One has to be aware of preciousness, of sentiments such as, my feelings are so tender and delicate, I must not expose them with all these rough, insensitive people around. One has to be very careful not to rationalise one's unwillingness to open up. The practice is to open, actually to say something. And then there's a question. It doesn't give the name of the questioner. The question: I have had the experience of things I have said being used as ammunition against me. Bhante: I don't think you should care tuppence about that. Answer: I know, Bhante. I shouldn't, but it affects me. Banti, I would therefore suggest that you hadn't been fully open. Because if you had, I don't think the misuse of what you had said would upset you even slightly. You should just feel sorry that someone had behaved in that way. You can only be exploited through your so-called openness if you haven't been fully open. If there's been some reservation in your opening up, it's only when you don't open up that you can be exploited psychologically through your fear. But anyone who did try to exploit you through your honest admission or confession, he'd be an absolute rat, wouldn't he? It would be a most unworthy thing to do, but it wouldn't bother you. You would have been open, and that's the great achievement. This would benefit not only you, but everybody, including even that rat-like person. So at all costs, be open within the spiritual community. Never mind the consequences. Otherwise, we are in this very false and dangerous position of making endless excuses not to open up. And because we never open up, we are never in a situation in which there is a real spiritual community. Instead, there are just a lot of frightened people sitting around, covering up, blaming one another, terrified that if they uncover themselves, they are going to be hurt. So open up and damn the consequences. Opening up is itself a great and positive achievement. Here I mean a real spiritual opening up, a very deep and genuine opening up, not just an airing of one's little weaknesses in a self-indulgent sort of way, expecting lots of love and sympathy. The sympathy one gives and gets should be of a more robust, bracing quality, not something consoling and sentimental. So there's just a little insight into Banti, into Sangharakshita, making a contribution to creating a culture of a real spiritual community, a community powerfully affected by the Dharma. So this is back in 1975, Banti's commentary on the Buddha's Udana, which I'll leave you with. It rains through the thatch, it rains not through the open. So open up the thatched, thus will it not rain through.